reception. Refreshments. Okay, good, good, good.
Tom, do you know, have any other information we can stick into something we need to get typed up on Peterson Castellano? This is pretty scant.
Yeah, Daly. Let's Daly. Daly, have you got a sec? Elma, you pick soon? You say you pick soon. Okay.
We want to hear the UPF. Yeah, right. We want the real thing.
I thought that what we would do now is just pursue this for a little while, this discussion that we initiated just before the break about the rationalization of relations between native governments, to put that very broad label on them, and state governments, particularly here in Alaska. And Ralph Johnson was going to say something, and then Walter Parker was going to add something, and then perhaps any others. And after that, we might ask Bill Dubé and Vernita Zilitz, both of whom wish to say something, to make their contribution. And after that, Alma Upikson and Kim Gottschalk, both here from NARF, have got some extended remarks each of them wants to offer. And then we'll turn to Mr. Starr, and then we'll go back to some of those who so fascinated us yesterday and the day before. And so perhaps we could just start off, Mr. Johnson, with you, and then go to Walter Parker.
Yes, I'd like to emphasize one thing I said before the break, and that is that I would like to be involved and hope that others here would also in a more intensive study of the potential different institutional structures that exist both in the lower 48 and in Alaska to see what the advantages and disadvantages of various ones are. It's not a subject that can be exhaustively explored in a plenary session. It takes some very hard, careful work, and I'm sure that is on the agenda of the commission. But in a broader sense, I wanted to make one comparison, and a fairly brief one, between the lower 48 and Alaska. In the lower 48, and especially in the Pacific Northwest, where I come from, there is a deeply held feeling by the states that the treaties were signed between the United States and the United States federal government and the Indian tribes, and the states were not part of that, and they don't want to have anything to do with it. And they have a general antagonism toward Indian tribal governments, Indian tribes. They don't understand, they have forgotten that in 1856 to 1860 that the Indians gave up about 41 million acres in the state of Washington, which is the state of Washington, in return for about 2 million acres and a few fish. A fairly bad bargain on behalf of the Indians, but nonetheless a bargain. In the state of Alaska, that exchange is much fresher, and I sense up here, but as still a newcomer, I sense that the state does recognize that the natives have certain economic powers, some bona fide economic, political, legal claims, and there is more of a willingness to deal back and forth, maybe in some hard terms, but to deal and exchange and negotiate than there is in the lower 48. So I would be a little bit wary of making too many comparisons in the lower 48, where views have fossilized and hardened and become rather difficult to deal with.
Walter Parker.
Convention, when the claim settlement was passed, the conventional wisdom of the legal establishment and those in government and so forth was generally against forming the village corporations. It was Alaska Natives who insisted on the village corporations, and the reason, of course, that the for insisting on the corporations was, as I said in the paper last week, that it was one of the few options that was offered at that time as an institution. And the but it was the wisdom of Alaska Natives, and you know, recognizing that the village is the institution which maintains that seamless web that Ted referred to, that seamless web of continuity, and that is the handhold to which you can reach out and grab hold and hope that you can hang on into the future. Now, we've interjected all these other institutions, and coping with them has been recognized as a problem ever since statehood, but with an increasing degree since the passage of the Act. In every village, you've got several institutions at play now, and as you found out, Mr. Chairman, in Tununic, of course, they expressed some desire to get rid of at least one or two of them so that they don't have to deal with all of these institutional conflicts that exist. And it's I agree with David Case that the constitutional barriers that have been raised against forming institutions which have some form of ethnic base or which relate to the totality of the village of an institution, I think those barriers are more perceived than real. I don't particularly read the Alaska Constitution that way. We've gone back and forth over it for the last dozen years in trying to deal with subsistence, and most unsatisfactorily, simply because it hasn't been approached with a really good faith effort to eliminate those perceived barriers. I have, you know, some confidence that within the framework of the federal constitution and the Alaska constitution, that the village as an institution can truly be created. And without trust relationships or any kind of imposition. The question, I think, is, and this is where not being a lawyer, why I can say this, I say the, you know, the question has been simply that that a tie partly with the legislative process that needs to be explored, but more, it has been the legal process which has intruded time and time again into the core of the village as an institution. Because as I said in the paper, you know, it's all based on the Western law, and the village simply did not evolve from there. And how do we resolve that particular conflict? We don't have to write a whole new code of law, because the code of law which the villages in many parts of Alaska still make their some of their most basic decisions based upon exists there, and it's not necessary for us to codify that, I don't think, in any Western law. It's necessary just to establish a recognition that these things do exist. The other two elements that intrude, the village has handled them themselves. The intrusion of Western religion is something that is, as I perceive it, being handled reasonably well. And the intrusion of Western business through the corporate structure or any other means is being handled. But the villages, as presently in their present situation, just have this extreme difficulty in coping with Alaska statutes, with the federal statutes as they impose upon them. So I think that's all I'd want to say at the moment, other than you simply have to make the kind of leap of faith that Alaska Natives made when they approached the Congress for the claim settlement, that, you know, good faith did exist in that in the United States on trying to resolve that, and the corporations were simply the best option that anybody evolved at the moment, and sit down, think hard, and take the next step in evolving an institution which truly reflects the village. In Alaska, I tend to use village rather than tribe because it did more aptly express the situation for most people, recognizing it in Southeast Alaska, why tribe is sometimes the more accurate description. But whether it is tribe or village, the same situation, the same remarks would pertain to either.
Thank you. Mr. Lerner?
Just a point of clarification, please. What do you mean when you say that the village handles the intrusion of Western religion fairly well? What does handles mean?
I mean that in Western religion and dealing, because it is fragmented, at least as it had approached Alaska, a very different situation from that in Latin America or other areas of the world, why, because it has been fragmented, there is more of an ability in the village to choose to accept or reject, whereas you don't have that same ability to accept or reject in the law. The law is imposed with some force if necessary, and so accepting, you know, that the acceptance of religion was under some, in many cases, under false pretenses, while at the same time, at this moment in history, I think the capacity exists in Alaskan villages to make their, to establish a concordant with whatever form of Western religion is in the village at the moment, or religions. In most villages, there are several religions present. Why, you know, they can, because they are not dealing with a massive institution. The massive institution that is accompanied by some force, they can handle that.
May I come back?
Yes, Mr. Lerner?
I take it you're speaking about proselytizing,
mm-hmm.
And you're distinguishing, proselytizing with the sword in the spirit of the Spanish conquistadores or Islam in earlier times from a situation where a missionary comes for some sect or other and tries to persuade people to give up their old ways. I'm trying to understand how, from the standpoint of someone living in the village, isolated somewhere, having this perhaps rare or unique confrontation with the white man speaking very different language. I mean language, not in the sense of the dialect, but to use the earlier term that was used, vision, how they are better able to decide freely for themselves.
The I think, you know, what I'm saying is that, you know, what has gone before has gone before, and at this particular time in history, the typical situation in Alaska Village is that the religious presence that's there has modified itself in many cases, to the needs of the village is, just as an anecdotal expression of that, there are two villages in western Alaska who are served by the same priest, and at the time that birth control measures were being taken out to the villages by the Public Health Service, why the health aides were right in the middle of this situation and, you know, under some trauma as to how to handle this, the Public Health Service was saying, you know, pass out the pills to your clients, and the priest was saying something else. Well, the same priest served the same two villages, and one health aide perceived the priest as giving her carte blanche to pass out the pills, and the health aide in the other village perceived the priest as imposing an absolute prohibition against passing out those pills. So that's why I say that because the priest had no legal authority to say, you will pass out those pills, the situation with religion is very different from that dealing with law, and that's why I feel that the villages have the ability to cope with the imposition of Western religion on their own terms.
The health aides being native in both cases, yeah. David Case and Tim Coulter.
Just a short kind of historical question. You said that the conventional wisdom opposed the idea of village corporations. I wondered if you did recall that there was another institution then that the conventional wisdom had in mind, or was there no other institution?
Well, they started out with, you know, the statewide corporation and kind of worked down from there as as far as the corporation went. There was a great jump forward at that time in the 60s against using anything that it had anything to do with reservations or which included the IRA councils at that time, because at least, you know, when I'm saying this, I'm not talking about Alaska Natives. I'm talking about those in state and federal government who are dealing with the issue. That there was no strong support for using the conventional institutions that were in use in the other states. Okay. So they very much wanted to create a new institution, and I think, considering the scope of the task, moved to the corporation fairly quickly, and hindsight is always easy, but had there been more intensive round tables throughout the state, and had there been possible to take more time, why a better institution could probably have been evolved. However, in that case, Alaska Natives might have missed the window in history which made possible a passage of the claims settlement. So that's, you know, the imponderables that you have to deal with on that one.
Yeah, just Mr. Lerner and then Tim Coulter.
I'd just like to remind you that the notion of the village is not all that alien or remote from either American experience or American law. The oldest forms of self-government in New England, and not only in New England, but in many of the original 13 colonies, were township governments, which were basically cases of the whatever the politically relevant part of the population was there, governing itself. That's probably the oldest political institution in this country. That it doesn't everywhere have the vitality and significance that it once had, or maybe that it has nowhere the vitality and significance that it once had, has to do with the dramatic changes that have occurred in American society and the economy, as well as the fact that we've got a Constitution of the United States. But it's by no means something fanciful to think of a recurrence to that form, adapted, to be sure, to the peculiar circumstances of Alaska. Alaska isn't Connecticut or Massachusetts, Massachusetts Bay Colony, but it's by no means outlandish to think that that oldest of American political forms, derived in part from English law, should have a life and significance here.
Do you want to add anything to that, Walter?
No, I'm glad that Ralph Lerner brought that up, because I believe that also, and you know, the village exists throughout the world. Only about 30% of the world's population lives in this highly mobile urban state and moves around. The other 70% still live in village, under village institutions. And these probably the urban areas, if they were wise, would you know, look for reinstituting the village as a more reasonable institution to live their daily lives under.
David
just,
Case?
Just another comment on that point. And I think Walt suggested it. Villages, I don't think, are really, we have to question whether they're a product of American experience and law, United States, European immigrant experience and law. As near as I can tell, many, if not most, Native American societies lived in villages, and certainly Pueblo, I believe, is translated into the word village. And so these, I guess I would say that, yes, indeed, the village is the oldest form of government in North America, and it was probably here before the Europeans arrived. But that's not really a function of law or politics. It's probably a function as much of population and location and convenience and other things that I'm probably not qualified to discuss.
I was only stressing it to suggest that, you know, to the extent that you're looking for forms that others can relate to out of their own experience, that's something that one might think about. I mean, these aren't merely you know, atavisms, you know, like our wisdom teeth or our appendixes. You drive on the roads of Massachusetts today, and you see that the boundaries are all township boundaries, and they tell you when it was founded, 1688, 1642, whatever. So I was trying to think of ways in which matters, arrangements that are native, so to speak, to the natives, might be rendered intelligible to the non-natives, that's all.
Tim Coulter?
Well, before we pass to something else, I wanted to just quickly list for the record some of the other examples of alternative forms of activity outside of strictly legal ones. One example has to do with law and order jurisdiction, where the Onondagas near Syracuse, New York, simply insisted upon being responsible for that themselves. They simply didn't permit the local law enforcement authorities to do that, and their cohesiveness won the day, and local law enforcement authorities, despite their supposed right to exercise jurisdiction there, just decided not to. Hunting and fishing rights have everywhere been maintained, to the extent they have been maintained, largely because Indian people have gone out and exercised those rights, usually in violation of the law. And in some instances, like Washington State, that's been followed, and I emphasize followed, by judicial decisions recognizing some of those rights. The Shoshone example, the Dan sisters, who simply continued to run cattle on their ranch and exercise their right to use their traditional land, has also been quite successful. They did that despite the legal pronouncements of all the non-Indian authorities, and the legal victories have followed that exercise of that right. The Hopis fought a long time to avoid the imposition of an IRA constitution back in the 30s. There's a rather well-documented history of that. After a very few years, the Hopis were successful in killing that constitution simply because they didn't take part in it. And the whole tribal council that was set up died a natural death because people just didn't go. They never had a quorum. It was totally destroyed in that way until finally the oil companies and the BIA set it back up again. But they were successful for moral and practical purposes. Bridge crossing up where the international bridge crosses the St. Lawrence River near the Mohawk Reservation has been another point of contention. The bridge authority started trying to charge a toll, and since the Mohawks don't recognize that reservation, don't recognize the border, they didn't like to pay a toll to travel back and forth from Canada to the United States. The bridge people took the name of one Mohawk and issued him a citation or a fine for running the toll gate. When other Mohawks found out that this little confrontation was brewing and found out that they too had an opportunity to run the toll gate, they lined up for the chance. The bridge people just had to cave in. There was nothing they could do, and they invented a way to permit the Mohawks to pass back and forth without paying the toll. The rejection of land claim awards has been another area where the law has been successfully resisted. There was an instance on one of the Seneca reservations where the clan mothers came out and literally forced the BIA officials to pack up their gear and leave. They had to hold a hearing, you see, before they could distribute a claim award. The clan mothers simply said, don't even bother to unpack. They unpacked anyway, but there are some famous things put in the transcript about, we want you off the reservation now and don't dilly-dally. It worked. The Bureau was totally unable to carry out their legal duties. The award has never been paid. Language and the insistence upon use of native language has also been important, especially where it regards education and governmental rights. There have been several examples of successful Indian schools where Indian parents have decided to set up their own supposedly illegal schools operated in violation of state and local laws, so that they could teach their children their proper language and carry on their instruction as much as they wanted to in their own native language. It seems that the lesson of this is, to quickly summarize, that the exercise of rights is often more important than what the letter of the law says. That secondly, the success of that activity often depends on the cohesiveness of the community in exercising those rights, especially in the language area, and I was discussing this with one of the Native women here, the ability of a people to be cohesive in their desires to maintain their language and carry on their affairs in their native language, that is important. But thirdly, I think, and Gandhi, the other Indian, and the example of Martin Luther King and many others seems to demonstrate that success also depends on the ability to demonstrate that the law that is being resisted is unjust and that the cause or the right being exercised is in fact just. And where those conditions are met, we seem to see a pattern of success.
While I think of it, a social note, the commission is having, is inviting you all, the panel and those people who have faithfully been attending, both the media and members of the public who've been faithfully attending last week and this week, to the commission's offices at 4:30 this afternoon, when refreshments will be served. And so you are all invited, and And now, this might be a good time to hear from you, Bill Dubé. Perhaps I might say that Bill Dubé is editor of the publication so much in the news at this roundtable yesterday, the Arctic Slope Record, Arctic Slope Review.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. It's a real privilege to address this group. Although I work for the North Slope Borough, this is in no sense am I speaking for them, but rather as a writer with a little background in philosophy, I suppose. I'd like to address two points, and the first, quite briefly, I hope, is your question about the state responsibility. John Havlicek made the statement last week that a lot of perceptions among natives, perhaps, about the performance of the profit corporations has to do with the fact that they expected the profit corporations to perform in the sense of tribal organizations and offer a much larger umbrella for the native peoples, especially in rural areas. And he said what in fact happened, and perhaps was the intention of Congress, was for responsibilities to be passed from the, not from the federal government to the profit corporations, but to the state. And certainly, this is what indeed did happen with ANCSA. It unleashed a whole slew of activities, which kind of overwhelmed the activity, or I should say the impact of the profit corporations upon the villages, and what gave all of this a big kick in the pants that nobody expected was OPEC, which in 1974 upped the price of oil from $3 to $30 a barrel and brought tremendous revenues into the state, which was then able, through political manipulation of the Native Caucus and things like that, to pour tremendous amounts of money and programs into the villages, and which a lot of villagers see as both benefits and as a kind of intrusion of, of white structures upon their way of life. This also brought improvements of situations, for example, medical care, made the villages much more amenable to nice places to live, and white people began moving out there because there were jobs available, and all of a sudden the natives saw themselves and their land is moving out of their own control. And I might suggest, that a lot of the discontent has to do not with the failure of ANCSA, but of its complete success and in ways that nobody had envisioned. And that very success is what's causing a lot of the discontent, that native peoples are looking for other ways to ensure what they expected from ANCSA to actually take place. In other words, having more control over their land, especially, and their relationship to the land. Secondly, I'd like to address some comments made by Mr. Lerner, and I hope I understood you right yesterday. And I can really sympathize with what he had to say in regarding the difficulties in a democracy of recognizing native sovereignty. It seems to go against the general democratic principle of avoiding classes of privilege and dual citizenship and this whole idea of being equal before the law. And these are questions that I have had. These are questions certainly that a lot of Alaskan natives have had. This is one reason that so many natives in Alaska have embraced American institutions so vigorously, including people in the North Slope Borough, as ways of protecting their native rights. And you'll see that, Mr. Chairman, as you go up to the borough to see how much the North Slope Borough has done in terms of language and studies and subsistence protection, and has led the way not only in Alaska, but oftentimes nationally and internationally in the protection of Aboriginal rights. But still, a lot of natives have questions about this, because of conflicts in the nature of these structures itself. And I'd like to point out to you, Guy Martin last week said that he thought a lot of this discontent was based on a vague sort of cultural insensitivity of the corporations to native interests. And it's not that at all. It's very concrete complaints. And And one good example of that was in the 1979 Beaufort Sea oil and gas lease sale. It was challenged by the North Slope Borough in court, along with several villages who joined with the borough in attacking that sale as being against the law because it violated provisions of the Environmental Protection Act, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and other legal instruments of the federal government, which gave special recognition to Aboriginal peoples and subsistence uses. And at the same time, there was at least one corporation, and perhaps two or three, Nana Corporation, I think Chelista, and perhaps Cook Inlet Regional Corporations, which were actually entering in the sale with other oil companies. And I think, that the other corporations would have done the same thing had not they came under tremendous political pressure from the North Slope Borough not to do so. And in these areas, you find a real poverty of leadership, and a lot of times you have the same leaders on the heads of the village corporations who are opposing the sale, who are also, you know, on corporation boards, who are placing bids in that same sale. And I think Rosita can come up with other indications, you know, of these real cultural conflicts. And as Byron Mallott pointed out last week, there are real conflicts having to do with the nature of the animal. And it has to do with a lot more than just the structure of the thing, but the whole constellation of symbols and values that go up to make the human side of that organization. And finally, I'd like to make the point that
just before you go on, Bill, could I just say for the record, because people will be reading this who are not intimately acquainted with the North Slope Borough, that it is a borough encompassing the northern 30% of Alaska, and where the populace is predominantly Eskimo, and thus Eskimo people have, I think it's fair to say, dominated that government from its inception.
We often say the Eskimo-run municipality, right? Mr. Lerner talked about the natives eschewing the idea of individualism and individual rights, and he questioned the idea of giving special rights to group, and I certainly have to agree with him. That's certainly very offensive to me, but what we're dealing here with is not so much questions of privilege, but questions of dual citizenship, which is something quite different. And this might be better understood if we analyze better this term sovereignty, which has created so much problem in the discussions of the past 2 weeks. You know, the idea of native sovereignty is not something that we've invented, or even that the natives have invented, but it was something that, you know, was kind of imposed on us by our ancestors, and then certainly came from our European background, that this concept that the right to self-government as relating from attachment to the land is very old and certainly very universal, going back way back into probably prehistoric times. It was certainly well developed during the Roman Empire. In fact, much of their legislation was based on that fact, and this was like a universal concept, you know, of all peoples, certainly up to the 15th century. And because of our mobility as Americans, you know, we've lost the sense of landedness, the sense of rights, individual rights, as well as social and political rights, as developed and directly dependent upon. And also, not only that, identity, both social and cultural and political identity and personal identity is radically based in your attachment to the land. It's foreign to us, but it certainly wasn't foreign to the explorers who discovered this land. You have to remember that by the 15th century, human beings successfully occupied every section of this globe quite successfully. And there was a belt of what's called the whole culture all over around the world, where people were successfully cultivating the land. And then when the Europeans arrived here, they saw civilizations that were not too much different than their own. And the only way that the explorers, who were kind of rednecks, you know, and renegades and adventurers, could justify their moving in on these people, whose sovereignty they didn't question, was to question their humanity itself, huh? And because they knew if they recognized that these people who were different and spoke different languages were really human beings, they were sovereign. And we have problems with the word sovereignty because it's got two very distinct and even opposing meanings. One meaning of sovereign has to do with a ruler. This comes from the obvious Latin term, you know, superanus, which meant, as you said, the guy who has the last word. And this has to do with relationships between individuals in a group. Who heads up this group? That's the sovereign. And as you said, we have a hard time delineating and defining who the sovereign is in our state, our country, because we did away with sovereigns. We divided that thing up. We put some sovereignty here and some sovereignty over here. We have a tripart government, and we've got federal, local, and state governments and all this kind of stuff, because we don't want sovereigns. That's why, you know, the best thing that we can say about ourselves is that the people are sovereign. Huh? And it's more correct to say there is no sovereign in this community, huh? In that sense of dealing with the idea of sovereignty. But there's another sense of sovereignty, especially as in reference to the term sovereignty as a noun, which deals not with individual relationships, but with group relationships. And the meaning of that sovereignty is freedom from external control. We established our sovereignty when we threw off the bonds with England. Huh? We defined ourselves as a sovereign nation. And in that sense of sovereignty, of dealing with groups between one another, there are limitations. We can't admit of degrees. We can't, in the older sense of dealing with sovereign as a king, you don't admit of degrees. A person is sovereign, he's got the ultimate sovereignty without any limitations. Huh? You can't say diminished sovereignty in that sense. But in the sense of sovereignty, meaning the group over which a sovereign has power, that certainly does admit of degree. Some groups are more sovereign than others. In other words, the state is less sovereign than the federal government. And in this sense, certainly is the sense in which our ancestors saw the native government as being sovereign, having some measure of internal control and freedom from our imposition of the Crown's control, some way of looking upon themselves. Now, the Greeks had a word for all of this, you know, which I think is very interesting, because the French use it in their reference to Aboriginal. It's in the French, I think, is autochtone. And we say autophona, and autochthonous. It comes from a Greek word, which is very revealing, because it's made up of two words meaning self and land, or self and earth. And it contains a lot of this Indian idea that the person doesn't own the land, but the land owns the person. And it's the land that defines selfhood and self-concept and responsibility, and defines the nature and the identity of the group, too. And the word came to be understood as meaning a person regarded as being sprung from the earth on which he inhabits, and all of his dignity, and all of his methods of thinking about himself and his relationship from the world is rooted in that attachment to the land. And this is very universal among mankind. This is not something new. This is not something that was invented by Charles V or Victoria de las Casas when they were asked to comment on this. Huh? This was something that came from long traditional background. The church recognized it, the Roman Empire recognized it, the Romans, and they're going out and developing a law which can encompass all of these different peoples, recognize that. And they not only saw that, you can't rule peoples, we can go over there and set up a governor who acts as kind of a peacemaker, and he can exact the tithes for the empire and all that, but you have to respect local leaderships because of the fact those people have been living there from time immemorial. And it's interesting to note that the French also use that term in reference to themselves. They see themselves as autochthonous, huh? As do most, but not all, European societies, of having resided there and having right to self-government because of their long, long tenure in the land. And we were discussing beforehand that the English got away with this precisely because they were overrun so many times by so many peoples, huh? The Romans, the Danes, the Normans, the Saxons, everybody else, and they're the ones that started developing concepts of dividing up this idea of property and land tenure and all this kind of stuff, because they knew they had to establish some kind of identity, some kind of relationship to the land as divided. And that's where we get our ideas of property, was the division of those concepts, but still in our own culture, in our own society, we still think of ourselves and our identity in terms of property. It might just be your home or something else, but this is one reason, you know, we defend capitalism so vigorously, because our identity and our self-concept are so rigorously attached to ideas of property and land. And so collectivization or tribalization of laws really are not opposed to traditional concepts of individual rights, but are actually very intimately related to them, and really based on them. You know, it's not a departure or something that goes against anything in Western society or the concepts of individualism or individual rights, but it's actually the whole basis on which those rights are rooted. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Dubé. Might I, for the record, ask Mr. Dubé to accept my apology. The magazine of which he is editor is the Arctic Policy Review, which is published by the North Slope Borough. Might I also just indicate that the North Slope Borough was incorporated as a first-class borough 1st July 1972, a home rule charter with